Can other people talk to me as well as at a conference call?
Yeah, it's like a regular seminar. You'll have questions. They'll interrupt you, and they'll put questions at the end as well.
How many people are on the line?
I don't exactly know, but there's four or five groups, and each of them probably 3 to 5 people.
Okay.
No, I think there's slightly more. There's some groups in Europe as well, and of course Canada and North America.
Very good. All right. Well, great. Well, thanks for inviting me on this thing. And you know, this is I think quite different to what you're used to, and not really. I'm not making any pretensions to beat mathematical theory. It's a kind of an effective theory for sort of a phenomenology. But anyway, let's start with
one thing you have to do is indicate us when you flip over a slide.
Yeah, okay. So to flip to page 2, and so the smallest interval of time. This, of course, is completely familiar to everybody here. So we have, for 100 years, we've had this this Planck time staring us in the face. It's apparently fundamental unit. The figure on the lower right shows you the basic instruction, that is, the quantum mechanics. The smaller you get, the higher the energy you go to. And with gravity, say black holes, it's just the other way around. For smaller energy, smaller mass corresponds to smaller Schwarzschild radius. And so those two theories are very comfortable coexisting on large length scale, far away from the Planck scale. But at the Planck scale, or below the Planck scale, it's not clear that there's consistency, and that, of course, is what you guys in loop quantum gravity are wrestling with all the time. So there's a characteristic time, and it's not easy to, again, you know more better than I do, but it's not easy to put together a consistent theory that that makes sense of that, especially at smaller scale, that you have to think about some quite different kind of transformation. If you just imagine having a Planck length ruler, a normal classical ruler in a space-time, and you do a boost along the ruler's length, well, you know, it ought to get shorter, but this kind of implies that there's a minimum length that it can't get shorter. Something else has to happen. But traditionally, that scale has seemed quite out of reach experimentally. There's been some ideas to detect signs of it, but the direct assault seems impossible because of the corresponding particle energies, 10 to the 16 TeV, 16 orders of magnitude. Got the capability of accelerating. Let's go to the next slide. And so, so traditionally the high energy frontier has been using accelerators to get you to an inverse TeV. That's about 10 to the minus 18 meters. And that's that gives you detailed knowledge of particle interactions. You actually create quantum states on that scale and smash them apart, tease them apart. So the approach I'm going to use is a different one. I'm going to talk about also trying to get to Planck scale physics, but not by direct access to particle states on that scale, but instead by accessing the positions of bodies to that precision. And so the technology is the gravitational wave interferometer, the LIGO Observatory, GEO-600 in Germany. The interesting thing is that technology, even now, is achieving precision of 10 to the minus 19 meters. In other words, it's 10 times smaller than the smallest collisions in CERN. Of course, they don't smash particles apart. They don't actually generate energies with that corresponding that large an energy. They're coming at it from the other side, from the upper side, the gravity side. But they do measure positions of things, or if you like, they measure wave functions in space-time to that precision. And they do that, and they measure coherence relative positions over the kilometer baseline. So there's an enormous dynamic range of scales as well. So, I'm going to talk about phenomenology of these things and whether Planck scale effects might show up in them. So the next slide. So the phenomenon I'm going to talk about, I call holographic noise. And if it's really there, we might be able to study that fine scale directly using interferometer technology. And I want to emphasize right away that it's not gravitational waves. It's not the same as gravitational waves. It's a kind of noise, but it's not gravitational wave background. It actually has a different geometrical character. It's not a strain, it's a shear, and so on. It's not even the same as zero-point fluctuations in the gravitational field in tensor mode. It's a different thing. Really talking about writing down a wave function for the space-time and based on holographic theory and deriving the uncertainty in that space in that wave function. There's a couple of ways to derive the uncertainty. One of them is directly just from information bound, holographic information bound. Either way, you can make predictions for the noise, kind of sampling noise, without any parameters. You have a controlled way to do the calculation. It doesn't mean it's correct, but it means that you can make a prediction. So the basic physics to think about in your mind, a kind of visualization, is that this is at a scale, big L, the scale of an apparatus, in this case, a kilometer or so, the effect is that the fraction of the Planck radiation on that scale, which is called the Rayleigh range, the Rayleigh diffraction for that scale, which means that the transverse width of a wave function is the geometric mean of the Planck length and the scale of the apparatus. Now that, of course, is much bigger than the Planck length. So if the effect is there, that's why you can see it. And the interesting thing is that the machines that people are building now have built actually achieve that level of precision for length. Okay, next slide. So in Germany, there's a machine called Geo600 outside Hanover, out in Farmer's Field. This is like a modest version of LIGO. And I'll talk more about this later. But let's go to the next slide, number six. About a year ago, I started backing these ideas around and talking about them. And Bernard Schuch told me that these guys at Geo600 had this noise they couldn't explain. So I sent them predictions for what I thought they should be seeing, and they sent me this plot back on page six. So if you look at this is what they call mystery noise. It's probably what they've been calling mystery noise for about a year and a half now. On the left side is it shows their noise. The blue curve is a plot of their data. It's a kind of snapshot of their data. Of course, that changes all the time, but if you look at the screen at Geo600, it fluctuates with not much variation around this blue curve. That's typical noise sample from the machine. And the green curve is the noise that they can account for in their noise model. The units are it's the power spectral density of equivalent gravitational waves today. Again, I'm not talking about gravitational waves, but this is the units they use to characterize their apparatus. So this has the units of inverse root hertz, or the square root of time, as a function of frequency. On the right side, shows again the data, the blue curve, but then there's the red curve at the bottom there is shown at a particular value, which is the square root of half the Planck time of these units, which is what I think should be the holographic noise in the system. And if you add the red curve to the green curve on the left, you get the green curve on the right. And as you can see, that just explains the difference between the two. The mystery noise is the gap between the green and the blue on the left side. And the high frequency mystery noise disappears if you add noise that has the white noise spectrum at the amplitude of half the Planck time. And so that's just very suggestive. In other words, this is the best machine in the world for this purpose. It's the most sensitive one. And they seem to see noise with just the right specific properties you'd expect. This does not explain all of their mystery noise. They also have overheating noise they haven't been able to explain. As you can see, there's still a gap at the left side of the right plot. And so this is not it's not the end of the story. It could be that there's another explanation for the redlining and the high frequency mystery noise as well. But it's not that surprising to have unexplained low frequency noise. That, of course, is the whole difficulty of gravitational wave work. So anyway, that's the reason to think about this more seriously. There might actually be a window here under the Planck scale physics. Let's go to the next slide, number 7. The basic idea, this is all I'm going to talk about. It's rather simple mathematical ideas. I'm going to motivate it with physics ideas. The idea is that space-time is a quantum system. So instead of assuming that there's a manifold, you know, the metric on a manifold, we're going to have a theory which is based on simple wave theory. In holographic theory, you think about having a light sheet, a quantum series, two dimensions, which is the speed of light, and the third D space dimension is identified with time. And then the uncertainty, the wave function that I'm talking about, is about the transverse position in those light sheets. If you take a theory like that, and you give it a maximum frequency, the Planck length, then as shown in the picture here, if you have a diffraction pattern, the wave function is the diffraction pattern, the width of the diffraction spread with distance, so the macroscopic distances. And so you end up getting a transverse indeterminacy in geometry much bigger than the Planck length. We go to page 8. And this is just a summary slide. I'll just walk it quickly. The idea is that you can get, by using ultra-precise position measurements, you would just expect this new effect, holographic noise. It's much bigger than the zero-point field mode fluctuations of gravity. It's really there. It has a lot to basically normalize, it's sort of calibrated from black holes in physics. That's where the whole holographic entropy comes from. And so you really may be studying that physics in the lab, what's going on. You can make predictions for the spectrum of spatial character, and so there's actually more experiments to do. Candidate detection is not the end of the line. If that's really what's there, there's a lot more to do. I'll talk about that at the end of the talk. So there's a couple of papers up about this, and the next ones are going to be more about how to build experiments. We want to do this follow up. Okay.
Wait, can I have a question here? This is Abhay Shekhar. Okay. So, you invoked these various holographic principles, I think, and light sheets and so on. And they were, in fact, introduced to be manifestly relativistic invariant. That's why one went to these null sheets and so on.
Yes.
But in the next line, when you say that there's a maximum Planck frequency, one breaks the relativistic invariance drastically, because I immediately ask you what frame is this maximum Planck frequency applicable. So isn't there a tension between these two ideas?
Oh, I think that there is. I mean, I think, so really the ansatz of what I'm talking about is that in any lab frame, there's a maximum Planck frequency. So however you build the final theory, it has to come out that way. I don't have a way to make that happen, but it does emerge that way in matrix theory. It can happen that way. In other words, you build a theory with a fundamental Planck. Well, I'll come to that later. You build a theory with a fundamental length into it. That's the compactification scale of the one dimension of the one built-in space dimension of the theory. And then when a space-time emerges from that, in any lab frame, it has to. So basically, what happens if you take, say, a Planck ruler and you try to boost to make it shorter than a Planck length, the degrees of freedom change, and it no longer looks like a light. It has a different character, say. Well, it goes into matrix form. I don't have much to say about that. I'm really going to be talking about the macroscopic limit of this. So if there's a theory that has a maximum frequency in any lab frame, this is the consequence of it. That's what I'm talking about.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so slide 9. I'm going to spend a little time on theoretical background before getting back to the experiment. I love this quote from its host. This is what we found out about nature's bookkeeping system. The data can be written onto the surface, and the pen with which the data are written has a finite size. Okay, that's illustrated by this cartoon from its host. That, you know, you take any three-dimensional volume, and you put a sphere around it. And of course, the paradigm of this is the black hole event horizon, which is where it all started. The black hole event horizon. You put Planck's area boxes on it. Each box is 4 L Planck squared area, and you put a 0 or a 1 in each of the boxes, and the number of ways of doing that is the total number of ways that physics can happen inside the volume, the three-dimensional volume. So there's two surprising things about that. One is that it's entropy before, number degrees of freedom proportional to area instead of volume. That's surprising. That's the holographic part. Also, that it has this finite resolution in it, and it has a finite size. So there is basically a countable number of states. So it's really surprising, and that's really the reason there's noise that I'm talking about, that you have that really drastic limit on the amount of information. If you go to the next slide, slide 10, this is just a kind of a pedigree. And just the listing is a kind of a history of ideas over the last 30 years that have led to this, kind of fed into this set of ideas. And I'll just go through these. Quite quickly. I mean, I'm not really going to try to do a deep theory review, but it's just interesting how many threads sort of lead to the same place. It's not a surprising conclusion. All of them suggest that you have that the world is built on a description, a fundamental description, maybe the fundamental quantum description, which is on two-dimensional quantum surfaces. With plus one at a time, which gives you the third dimensional plane. So we go to number 11. So it starts the story of the history of this black hole thermodynamics, early 70s. Right, in those days, people noticed that look at the classical solutions of Einstein's equations, and they obey laws. That's the solutions of a law, which is just like a law of thermodynamics. Particularly, you identify the area of total area of event horizons with entropy. You find that classical GR that always increases, and the entropy you identify that with entropy. The later found the multiplier is a quarter, but the area of event horizon in Planck units is the entropy. So that leads to the suspicion that maybe it really is an entropy, and it is an entropy for it actually is a count of the degrees of freedom, and maybe for the same reason that entropy works in normal thermodynamic systems made of atoms, because there are microscopic degrees of freedom, and the statistics of them sort of conspire to give you this thermodynamic behavior at large scales. So let's go to the next slide. That was quickly followed up with black hole evaporation. So you take the entropy idea seriously, and you take the laws of thermodynamics seriously, that black holes not only have entropy, they have temperature. And so then if they actually evaporate, they convert both their energy and their degrees of freedom from gravitational form, the vacuum solutions of a black hole, into actual particles that fly off to infinity. So that made it even more suggestive and compelling to think that maybe those gravitational, there are microscopic gravitational degrees of freedom in the vacuum solutions, which can be interconverted with other forms of mass energy at infinity. Of course, there was a long debate about whether information is lost in this process. I think now people agree that quantum mechanics won and unitarity is preserved, and the number of degrees of freedom in a black hole, after it disappears, is the same as the number of degrees of freedom in all the evaporated quantum system that it leads to. in any case, the idea that it's the black hole entropy, and it completely accounts for all the information of the evaporated state, you know, one mass to the other, in a unitary way. Again, feeding back to the idea that everything about a black hole, including all the ways that you can make it, all the history, all that can be described by information on its two-dimensional null surface represented by its event horizon. Okay, so go to the next slide. So one point about this, if you think about the evaporated product of a black hole, this is kind of an aside actually, but if you take one of these, say an evaporated particle typically takes away 1 degree of freedom or so and goes very, very far away with a wavelength about equal to the original size of the hole. If you wait long enough, then that particle goes off to very, very far away. And its angular position relative to the hole becomes better and better defined because the baseline is far away and its sort of angular physical size is just fixed; it's just drifting away. If you don't have some kind of information limit to the distance space time, you would lead to a contradiction with the information of the hole. It would take too much information to specify where all those evaporated particles end up. And if you want to match the number of position eigenstates to the final evaporated products with the number of states of the original hole, you have to have some kind of indeterminacy in the final position. That's kind of a prelude to what I'm going to talk about later. Anyway, move on for now. Go back to that. So slide 14. So what is this about black holes, right?
Excuse me. Yeah, Craig, this is Lee Smolin. Maybe you want to rush right back to this, but this is I'm pretty familiar with all kinds of, with the spectrum of arguments about holography and black holes, et cetera. And this is a novel argument so far as I know. Is there a are you claiming that there's an indeterminacy in the transverse position of a photon far from a black hole, which somehow accounts for the loss of information during the evaporation process?
It mitigates the need for a loss of information, yeah. But there is that transverse indeterminacy that I'm going to be coming back to later, is what you need to make the position state count agree. Yeah.
When you come back to it, will there be a calculation? Because this, to my knowledge, this is a novel idea. Is there a calculation that supports that claim?
There's a rough calculation, but I will be the first to admit that one needs more work. I haven't written a paper. I've only written a couple of paragraphs about that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. I would like to talk to you more about that later offline. That's good. Okay. All that's fine. So page 14. So nearly flat space time, right? So it's not just about black holes. Same argument seems to apply. You've got under radiation. You also have event horizon. And, anyways, without going through the details, it's not just about black holes. The idea is that the gravity everywhere might have a holographic character. So, page 15, right? So that led Swift and Susskind to coin the idea of the holographic principle, starting with black holes, but then you basically think that that's a general property that elevates the idea of a principle. And Busa put it in a covariant form to show that it can be consistently formulated in a covariant way. You could look at the regularity of the classical Einstein theory and guess that maybe they would be explained by an origin in a quantum theory with this property. So, page 16. From the other side, string theory and so on, the ADS CFT correspondence, so it actually concrete examples of holography of series in different dimensions being dual to each other, gravity and merging, as in a bulk theory. Of course, those don't have, you know, it hasn't given us a theory yet for our Minkowski statements, right? But you know, there's a suspicion that it exists. So it's page 17. Again, this is sort of specific examples, and then, you know, apparently there are, you know, specific examples of where you can count the quantum space, the extremal black holes, and degrees of freedom, and show that it actually agrees with the thermodynamic argument. And those types of ideas also give you an inclination of how you could have a minimum length at the Planck length. And, you know, when you go try to push theory too far beyond the Planck length, you go into its dual, actually a minimum theory, minimum length in the theory. Okay, so there's a, let's go to page 8. What I'm going to talk about is, say that you have the space-time as plus mass energy together, some kind of holographic quantum system, right? I don't really know the detail. We're going to talk about just the macroscopic behavior. But the idea that there is a world in any frame can be described by, can actually be described by quantum. If there's this maximum frequency, I'm going to use that kind of effective null field as a basis to make wave functions from. And then compute what wave functions would look like. So maybe I'll skip 19, you know, let's go straight to 20, running out of time. So here's a quick and dirty argument for why you get holographic noise. This is just basically saying, this is not about waves, it's about counting degrees of freedom. So page 20, you have a theory with two conditions, that you have a maximum Planck frequency in any frame, and that you have on light sheet, like in a TIS cartoon, you have a Planck wavelength resolution. You don't have, you know, 1 degree of freedom per Planck length. And you just count the degrees of freedom in the system. You have 2 degrees of freedom per wavelength. So let's go to page 21. So here's a space-time diagram. So we have a vertically time, and x and y axis, and it's suppressed the third space dimension. So this is the y dimension here, is the emergent one. So saying that in the yt plane, you know, each plane really represents a two-dimensional surface, and that 45-degree line is a light sheet moving. We can just look at this segment along the x-axis, sweeping through space. So it's just x segment sweeping through space at the speed of light. So the hypothesis is that on that x-axis, there's 1 degree of freedom per Planck length, but it sweeps out a two-dimensional surface. It sweeps out this two-dimensional surface that's in bold, the sheet. Okay. The number of, if you say, let's say that there are sort of pixels in that surface, distinguishable position, the separation delta x, and the size on each side is a big L, then the L over delta x squared is the number of two-dimensional pixels, and that's equal to the number of one-dimensional pixels in the one-dimensional segment, same number of degrees of freedom. And that, then you get this scale of geometric behavior, delta x squared is the product of L and the Planck length. That's just counting degrees of freedom. Now if we go to, but it does tell you that it essentially comes just from, it just comes from that. This comes from degrees of freedom. It's not a detailed thing. It's not dependent on subtleties of the theory. Go to,
So assumption is that the degrees of freedom remain the same on these lines parallel to the x-axis that you have? Is that the assumption?
Yeah, so everything on the swept out surface is holographically encoded at a single time on at x. Basically, if t and y equals zero.
Okay, and then if I go back, I mean, you're going forward in time, but But if I were to go back in time outside your plane, outside the picture, the cube that you are drawn, but just backward in time, I just continue your slanted 45 degree surface backward in time. Then delta x keeps decreasing, is it?
Oh, no, no. From you choose from a given point in time, or a point on the null trajectory, you get the same relative uncertainty. It's a relative uncertainty between two null sheets, two positions of a null sheet. So if you go back in time, you get the same uncertainty. The wave function actually describes an indeterminacy wave function in relative transverse position.
What is capital L? What is capital L?
It's the size of the cube.
So then, I mean, if I just choose twice
bigger
as much.
Bigger L will give you bigger delta x, and that's right. It's what comes later, the bigger interferometer has larger holographic displacement. Right.
Okay.
So page 22. So I thought it would be useful to see, this is a kind of a partially worked example. So there's a candidate theory of everything, matrix theory, the Banks et al. Theory. One example. I'm not basing it on this, but this shows how things might work. So that theory is not based on space-time emergence, and it emerges from 9 n by n matrices. We have the n objects, so the n is the basically amount of matter, the zero range of particles. And eventually those 9 matrices give rise to 10 space dimensions. One of them, the m dimension, is compact, as shown at the bottom. You have this one dimension compactified at the Planck scale, and the others arise from the matrix, an emergent property. So page 23. So that maps onto what I just showed, basically by saying that two-dimensional, 7 of the 9 are tiny dimensions, and we'll forget about them, but 2 of them are large and correspond to the 2 dimensions of the light sheet. Okay, so this is like a concrete example of Einstein's right of the photon. What would the theory look like if you were on a light sheet? It would look like these matrices. So, 24. So mathematically, the way it looks like is that you have a Hamiltonian here. In that Hamiltonian, so R is a compactification scale. The positions in the light sheet are the traces along each. Remember, each matrix has a dimension. The trace is the center of mass position of the particle in that dimension. In this Hamiltonian, the only term that matters for what I'm talking about is the first one, the kinematic term, the product to two capital pi. These are the two conjugate momenta. So if you, I guess I want to go to page 25, actually. This is better. Go to 25. I put Planck's constant back in. So the first term is the momentum term. And just thinking about the x dimension, right? You take the trace of the conjugate momenta. That's very much like taking the product. If you put that into wave language, map those conjugate momenta onto a d by x dimension, Schrödinger's wave. Then you look at this next equation. The right hand side of the top equation becomes the right-hand side of the bottom equation. The product of the pi becomes the product of the d by the x. Now the Hamiltonian operator is, as usual in Schrödinger wave theory, is d by dt. So you get a Schrödinger-like equation from the matrix Hamiltonian. And that's also what people in optics call the paraxial wave equation. So the other interesting thing about this is that Planck's constant cancels out. Right? It had Planck's constant in, but now it's gone. So even the Schrödinger equation doesn't have Planck's constant in. It just has R, has classification. And what that describes in optics language is the transverse behavior of correlations on optical wavefronts. It's what you use in laser theory to describe the spreading of beams. what they call the Fraxel wave equation. Which is why, so again, it's just to motivate this why an optical theory, and this is the kind of effective theory I'm talking about, might grow naturally out of matrix theory, out of some fundamental theory. Possibly out of blue quantum gravity, I don't really know.
Craig, just to clarify this. So the BFSS Hamiltonian is in null coordinates. So it's not a d by dt, it's a d by dz, where z is some x longitudinal minus t.
Yeah, that's right. A z plus, that's right. So I wrote it this way to show the parallel, but you're right. If you were really going to write it, it would be d by dz, or d by dz plus, the Lightsheet coordinate. And then, in a holographic theory, when you choose a holographic frame, they're the same thing, right? In a lab frame, the elapsed time is the same as the distance for that wavefront.
Yeah, but why couldn't I have made this argument directly just with Maxwell theory? Does Maxwell theory...
You can. You can. In fact, that's what I've done with my paper. I just used Maxwell theory. I just wanted to show why. It can tie into the fundamental. But yes, in fact, when they do optics, that's what they do. They get the paraxial wave equation straight from the linear wave equation. Exactly.
Okay. The general question that I have is really, I think maybe that's how you came to this idea, but you spend a lot of time about holography, et cetera.
Yeah.
When I look at the calculations, and when I look at what you're saying,
yeah,
it doesn't seem to have anything to do with holography. It seems to have something to do with maybe some non-commutative geometry or some computation relations, maybe. Is that fair, or is that not? Am I missing something?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it does not at all use the non-commutative geometry of the matrix theory. Those terms we're not using at all. But it is true that in the when you choose a holographic frame of reference, you're choosing a wavefront in a three-dimensional space. You measure, say you measure position, by counting wavefronts, by counting lights, along the light sheet. That's true that does not commute with measuring a position in a five-fold dimension. And that is the reason. That's the reason why you get the whole ground noise.
Right.
But
that's completely independent of anything else, right? I mean, I could just postulate some commutation relations between these positions. That's the heart of it.
Yeah, I think you could. That's right. You could do that, too. That's right. That's another way. That would be another way to formulate it.
Okay.
That's right.
And a quick other question is just for those of us who think in terms of quantum geometry and so on. Somehow you don't have a classical space-time metric anywhere, but the notion of sharply defined light sheet is well defined.
Well, they're only sharply defined at the Planck, up to the Planck resolution, and only in one dimension, right? I mean, that is, you have to choose an orientation. But let me move two slides now. Let's go to slide 27. This will help clarify. So this is going back to sort of freshman physics, okay? So it's about going back and forth between the wave description of a field and the ray description of the field. And of course, the ray description is like a classical metric pad, and the wave description is really what I'm talking about. I'm saying that the wave description is the right one here. So if you have an aperture of size d, and you have wavelengths lambda for the radiation. Of course, there's a diffraction angular resolution limit of lambda over d. It's the smallest angle that you can where rays make sense to describe what the waves are doing. And so, at a given distance l, there's a size of a diffraction spot, which is l times that angle, l lambda over d. Now, so if you can talk about a characteristic size d at a given L, where the size of the aperture is the same as the size of its diffraction spot. And that's an interesting scale, right? If you have a bigger aperture than that, then diffraction is unimportant, and you're just casting a shadow, or you have a hole in a screen that big, the diffraction edges are negligible. If you have a smaller aperture than that, then it's like a pinhole, and and the diffraction pattern is actually bigger than the whole. And this is the characteristic scale where I'm talking about. It's the size of the aperture where the ray description is least imprecise. It's the most it's the least indeterminacy you can have in the positions of the endpoints of the ray. You make either the aperture bigger or smaller, then the sum of the positions of the endpoints of the rays gets bigger. It gets bigger either one end or the other. And so this is what corresponds to what people call the Rayleigh range in optics. And it's basically the optical metaphor of what I'm talking about. And so the mapping onto the space-time metaphor for this, the size of the aperture in the diffraction spot corresponds to the transverse wave function of position and the minimum size of the wave function is the minimum indeterminacy of the space-time. So let's move on to 28. I'm going to run out of time. Maybe I should speed up a little bit. Let's move on to 29 just gives a bulleted summary of how you do this in wave optics. And then, so basically 29 just says, you know, if you go to Born and Wolf, you can do this with wave optics. You get a number out. And so page 30, the answer you get is if you identify the transverse positions of wave functions, is that the standard deviations of the wave function on two sheets have their product is given by the product of the Planck length and the separation of the sheets.
So, I think it would be useful for us to know what is sigma and sigma prime. For those
people. Yeah, sorry, say what?
What sigma and sigma prime are?
Yeah, those are the standard deviations, okay, of the width of the wave function in the sheet. Okay? So, you know, so if you have a Gaussian wave function, it's just the sigma of the Gaussian at one sheet and another one. Okay, so we just
have a null sheet and we have, say, x, y directions in that sheet?
Yes.
And sigma and sigma prime are those Gaussian widths in the x and y direction, is that right?
Just take x, you can do them separately. So in the x direction in the sheet, that is, there's a Gaussian width of sigma.
Yes.
And in another sheet, L away, the null distance L,
okay.
The sigma for the X there, one of them sigma prime, one of them sigma, and those two have this relation. So it's like an uncertainty relation. Just like the aperture and diffraction spot.
Okay.
So page 31, it's If things behave this way, it's kind of interesting because the approach to classical limits is unusual. The angular uncertainty of things, as you go to larger L, becomes smaller. So things really do become more classical and become more three-dimensional on larger scales, right? Delta theta is L Planck over L to the 1/2. And the larger things are, the less you notice the angular indeterminacy. And of course, conversely, if you go down to the Planck scale, the third dimension has not yet emerged, and the angular indeterminacy is of order radians. But the interesting thing is that if you go to not to angles but to spatial indeterminacy, actually the actual position, the delta x in the light sheet, that gets bigger at larger separation, and which is why it might potentially be observable. So we go to page 32. Well, this is just a cartoon. The idea is that if you're living in sightwood in hologram, maybe you can see that uncertainty. On page 33, another just a laboratory example of that. If you're looking at an actual laboratory hologram, Jesus, right? I mean, the holograms are blurry because of that characteristic scale, geometric mean of a light wavelength at a laboratory scale is about a millimeter. So they always They look blurry. Holograms look blurry for the same reason. So the effect I'm talking about is the equivalent of that, except with Planck wavelength, assuming it's your Planck wavelength radiation. So on page 34, again, this is just to show that it's a familiar thing, that the effects of finite wavelength manifest is a much larger scale. It's used all the time in interferometry. They either hear the diffraction pattern or the, in some cases, the uncertainties of species measured by that are much bigger than a wavelength. It's just the same relation. I think I better skip a few slides at this point.
You can certainly speak till 11:15 or so. So we have the bridge until then.
Okay. Let me just go a little bit faster. So I don't want to leave time for questions. Okay. Let's leave time for questions. That's probably better. Let's get to page 39. I want to start talking about experiments. So you take that basic idea of this kind of optical wave model for space-time position, give you a model for how non-locality and coherence work. In that model, we want to describe real machines, interferometers, ways to, maybe ways to look at the Planck scale. They have the property you need. They measure transverse positions. They measure them very precisely, and they measure them coherently over a large length scale. So the big L that I've been calling is dimension. L is the kilometer scale of the apparatus. The delta X is the precision with which they can measure the positions of optics. And that's the fractional precision at angle. The delta X over L that they measure is about 10 to the minus 20. It really is about halfway to the Planck scale. They really are measuring the geometric mean of the size of the apparatus on the Planck scale already. So the other thing about them is that they're designed for this gravitational wave work. They've minimized all the standard forms of uncertainty noise, including the standard Heisenberg uncertainty, standard quantum limit, has been minimized. They have massive optics so that the wave functions of positions intrinsically, the Heisenberg, which is a wave function, is very narrow. And so in the theory that I'm developing, I'm ignoring all of that and just talking about the additional uncertainty, the additional uncertainty and noise from the space-time wave function, if it's there. And ask the question, how would the holographic noise appear in the signal of an interferometer? So to go to page 40, well, I already showed this picture. So let's go on page 41. So to the heart of a machine, of a Michelson interferometer, is the beam splitter. So this is, it's a half-silver mirror, transmissive optics, with silver on one side. And so in the schematic diagram on page 41, there's light coming in from the top, a laser beam comes in from the top, and half of it reflects the top green dot. Well, that's misleading, of course. It doesn't reflect at a point. There's a whole wave front that reflects at a moment. But that green dot indicates a moment when the wave front moves to the right, half the wave front moves to the right. The other half of the energy of the wave, coherent state, goes through the optic on the other arm, and it comes back, and there's a second reflection of it at the other green dot. And then those two are, of course, then from the other arm, there's a return beam, and the two are then combined on the left panel, what's called the dark Purdy interferometer, where you measure the signal. And the phase of the signal tells you the difference of the integrated distance along the two orthogonal arms. And usually that's an integrated metric, and you're looking for gravitational waves. But here, we go to page 42. We're looking for a transverse change in the position of the beam splitter itself. So, and here this is a schematic indication of this. So solid line, there's some nominal classical position for the beam splitter, but we have these two reflection events, and in the holographic frame of sort of the holographic wavefront moving along with the laser beam, there's one reflection event, and then another one, which is two arm lengths later. And between those two events, there's a transverse holographic uncertainty. And so the dashed lines sort of indicate width of that uncertainty. That so the baseload is going to be in a different place at the two reflections, and the final signal has uncertainty because of that. There's a difference in the phase because of that. So in page 43, just indicates how you compute that from the wave theory. You have those two position events. They're the position of the insulator is described by wave functions, which the wave function is given by the sigmas. And so the variance in the position difference, the delta L squared, is given by 4 times L Planck L naught. So that's the basic effect. And that enters into the single stream of the interferometer. So if we go to page 44, this gives us just a rough way to put this into the language they use to describe the effect, which is power spectral density. Right, power spectral density is this quantity of h sub h squared. It's the if you integrate that over frequency, you get the mean squared displacement. It's a dimensionless thing, and so if you put in the numbers from the above, what you find is that the power spectral density is just given by the Planck times some numerical factor. The numerical factors depend on the apparatus. It depends upon how many times the beam folds and things like that. In GEO-600, there are two folds, and so that's why you get E Planck over 2 for the power spectral density. So if we go to page 47, you have this characteristic, page 45. I read that wrong. Page 45, you have this prediction of universal holographic noise. The twiddles is there because it depends upon the equivalent gravitational wave noise. It depends on the apparatus, but there is just a number which doesn't have parameters, which is a general property of holography. It just depends upon the Planck scale. So there's a false probable prediction. There aren't parameters in the model. And again, sort of thinking back to it, that makes sense because it's just a consequence of the information balance, the fact that you don't have enough data on a two-dimensional surface to specify all the positions of the beam splitter if you don't have this sampling noise.
Craig?
So
this is a question that's puzzled me about your argument. And it's similarly, Giovanni Emiliano Camelia a long time ago made similar arguments, but for the longitudinals. And I had the same issue. Why does this become noise? That is, if this is a quantum mechanical effect, isn't the thing, if we're looking at page 44 or the page before that, isn't what you want to say that there's some quantum mechanical coherence superposition over wave functions which reflect at different points? And therefore, they should add quantum coherently rather than as Brownian notion noise.
So this kind of comes back to the earlier question. It's really critical that you have these two orthogonal arms, i.e., non-commuting variables. Right? I mean, they're non-commuting. So the observable in the system is combining quantities which don't commute. And so there is an uncertainty which is just like Heisenberg uncertainty. That's why there's noise. If you observe the system for a very long time and sample it over and over and over again, then it does eventually you can build up a probability distribution and the centroid of that distribution becomes better defined. And that is not a, but the signal looks as if the position of the beam splitter is wandering. It actually gives a kind of bounded random walk. And if you have an apparatus which is bounded in a given size, you can think about this as a set of modes, where there's a wave packet that spreads. Think back to the wave equation. The solution of the wave equation is a solution of eigenstates. And if you have a wave built out of those eigenstates, if you try to make it very narrow, it'll spread. If you make an observation at one moment, and then come back later, between the two moments, the wave packet will have spread and get a different answer for the second position. The second position measurement, then you collapse the eigen state again, but it just starts spreading right away. And the amount by which it spreads over the light travel time is the indeterminacy of noise. You can't get around that.
Okay.
That answers your question. If you have a purely longitudinal system, if you don't have a beam splitter, if you just have an interferometer cavity. Actually, I make this comment later in the talk. If you just have an interferometer cavity, there is no holographic noise. If you're just counting wavefronts, then you can count. You just count. You know, Planck wavefronts arriving with Planck precision. And there's no uncertainty in that. It's only when you measure the transverse correlation that you get this.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So let me see. So page 46. So it's kind of weird. This is a summary of some of the weird things about it. It's not like thermal noise. It's not a heat bath. Doesn't carry energy information. Or it doesn't carry any information. It's sort of lack of information. Is what it is. It's a shear. The geometrical character is a shear. So it does not. You can't describe it as a perturbation in the space-time metric. It's a perturbation of the positions of things in a flat space. The way I described it. In other words, the metric would just be a gauge mode. But there, you know, you can have, you know, if it were a classical position, you can definitely. It says that the different transverse positions in this sense are not distinguishable. There's a fuzziness to them. So it's more like sampling or pixelation noise rather than thermal noise. Really, it is like an information limit. And as we were just saying, you can't detect it. It's just a radial measurement. So page 47, getting back to GEO-600 now. In fact, let's go to page 48. The thing about GEO-600, the reason that it has, this is the optical layout, the reason that it has the best sensitivity for this effect is that if you look at this optical layout, you can see that the heavy red line is where the high-power laser light is. It's where the recycled cavity is, the power recycle. And that includes the beam splitter, which means that basically every time the beam goes to the beam splitter, there's some holographic noise added. That's the optical feature that makes this a particularly good machine for it, unlike LIGO, which I'll come back to in a minute. So on page 49, you can see there's been this evolution of noise in GEO over the years, gradually ending up with the blue curve at the bottom. And the holographic prediction there is the red line below it. Going to page 50. Page 51. So this page 51 shows the noise budget as of about a year ago, last May. And it really hasn't changed. They haven't cracked out any new sources of noise. This is what goes into the noise model that I showed earlier. And it kind of shows where the holographic noise comes into the budget. It's some frequencies, it's the main noise. In other words, at their most sensitive frequency, at the moment, if this is what's going on, the holographic noise is the dominant noise in the system. So page 52 is the slide I already showed you, which kind of shows that the holographic noise fills the gap at the minimum. It explains the mystery noise, if it's real. Now, the thing about this is that it's not the transverse character of the noise is critical. If you go to page 53, if you look at LIGO, for example, LIGO is a better machine than GEO-600 for detecting gravitational waves. And so the graph here shows the strain noise in LIGO and the holographic spectrum, the square root of the Planck time. And it looks like the holographic prediction is ruled out because it's way above the measured LIGO noise. Apparently, LIGO is quieter. But remember that what this is plotting is the equivalent gravitational wave signal, and I've naively put the holographic noise on there, which is really the wrong thing to do. And it's because of this point that we were just talking about. And on page 54, if you have normal incidence optics in a cavity, the phase signal doesn't show you where the transverse positions of the optics are. Right? You can move those end mirrors up and down as much as you want, and it doesn't affect where the wavefronts go. But at the bottom, you know, is a beam splitter. If you move a beam splitter in the plane of a wavefront, then it does affect the phase of the reflected wave. That's why the beam splitter has, because the transverse position of the beam splitter enters into the signal of an interferometer. And in GEO-600, that's where the noise is coming from. So if you ask the question on page 55, why doesn't LIGO detect holographic noise? The answer is that their layout is different. So the lower right figure here, 55, one reason LIGO is more sensitive for gravitational waves is that it has 4-kilometer arms instead of folded 600-meter arms. But the main reason that it's more sensitive is that within each arm, there's a Fabry-Perot cavity. The red arrows are pointing at these. And there's an extra inboard mirror. And what that does is it builds up laser power in the arm, but not at the beam splitter. So when a gravitational wave comes along, they're looking at low frequencies, right? So gravitational wave corresponds to like slow and adiabatic stretching of the arm. And the effects of the gravitational wave accumulate in that cavity. As the cavity expands and contracts, the effect on the signal phase accumulates, and that makes it more sensitive for gravitational waves. In other words, for gravitational waves, it's like having a longer arm. But it's not like having a longer arm for holographic noise, because the holographic noise is limited by the size of the apparatus, the length of the arm. So if you look at at page 56, the bottom line 56 shows you a rough estimate of where LIGO's holographic noise should be. It's less by about the square root of the finesse of those Fabry-Perot cavities. In other words, it's below their measured noise. And that's a rough estimate. I don't actually know whether that's not numerically reliable, but in any case, it's not surprising that LIGO wouldn't have seen it yet. Okay, so page 57.
But you do think that, I mean, although it's a rough estimate, you do think that advanced LIGO will be sensitive to this, right?
Yeah, that's right. Advanced LIGO, and again, I don't have good numbers for it, but it should start becoming a problem for advanced LIGO, right? Because they are planning on digging down another significant factor.
Yes.
So for page 57, is this discovery where we're at? If it's there, then the interferometers that we have can detect it already if it exists, and there are signatures you can look for. So page 58, the summary of current experiments, GEO-600 sees noise compatible with that indeterminacy. The experimental group has published this, and they're being wisely cautious. They require testing and confirmation. They say it's way too early to claim we might have seen something. Carsten Dasman says the agreement is way too good, but on the other hand, they're taking it seriously enough. They're contemplating doing a follow-up experiment. There's discussions with them about it. Either way, they're operating at the holographic noise limit, so either they're seeing it or they're not. If they're not seeing it, then they'll be able to rule out the effect. So either way, it's an interesting threshold they're at. And with LIGO, they're not sensitive enough, but the upgrades, they probably will be. So I guess moving on, 59, where you could eventually go with this, right? Eventually you could measure, measuring the Planck time directly instead of using Newton's constant. That's an interesting new frontier for experimental studies of some aspects of Planck scale physics, including these emergent holographic characters of the geometry. Page position, page 61. You really want to, so page 61, what do you do next, right? With the gravitational wave machines, they're optimized for gravitational waves, which is low frequencies, and really there's no reason to do that because for all the gravity noise, because it has a flat spectrum. And you can think about studying at much higher frequencies where some aspects of the interferometry are a lot easier, like the suspension, the isolation, things like that. So we're talking about building an experiment where you have two miniature LIGOs, say. It's 40 meters instead of 4 kilometers. And you put them next to each other, and you correlate the signals in the two interferometers. So because they're smaller, the holographic displacements are smaller, which makes it, the signal doesn't compete as well with, say, photon shot noise. But you compensate for that by correlating the signal between the two of them, and you can, which then is an additive cumulative effect. This would not be practical technology for gravitational waves, because the equivalent gravitational wave density would be enormous and unphysical, but for holographic noise, you can reach an interesting level of sensitivity. So at page 62, we actually have a conceptual design for this that we've been working with Ray Weiss and others. If you put two 40-meter Michelson interferometers next to each other, and you have a 1,000-watt cavity like GS600, then you can reach the holographic noise limit, one sigma, which is given by laser photon shot noise, in about 5 minutes. So it means that you could have a significant detection in about a day with a machine like that. Probably costs, I don't know, a few million bucks. We don't really have a firm estimate. Anyway, it's a lot easier than gravitational wave to do this. And it really hasn't been done. This kind of thing hasn't been done yet. Since it hasn't done, hasn't been done anything. It would not be a good way to look for gravitational waves. So final slide, page 63. There are things that you can do. You can look at the correlations in LIGO between the two interferometers. It's not clear that the data they have are high enough quality to show the effect. GEO600 is the frontier right now. They're making upgrades and doing some retuning and might be able to disprove the effect without building a follow-up experiment. That's the current activity. I'm going out there next month, and we'll see. And they're spending quite a lot of time on it, because this is, whatever it is limiting their sensitivity at the moment. We're doing a conceptual experimental design for high frequency. Eventually, there are other technologies you could use, like atom interferometers.
Hello?
You might have run out. You might have run out of battery, I guess.
Oh, I guess so.
I was about to ask a crucial question here.
Let's see if he comes back.
So, why don't you meanwhile keep us occupied?
Okay, so my question...
Hello?
Hello? If I understand...
Somebody's back? Is Craig back? No. Lee, go ahead.
If I understand the argument, the effect...
My phone just dropped out. Say again.
So, Craig, I have a question. This is Lee again. If I understand the argument, going back to your slide 48, the effect, the prediction for one pass of the beam splitter, which is square root of T Planck over 2, for the noise is enhanced by the square root of the number of cycles of the photons through the beam splitter. And on page 48, you see that the effect is enhanced because you're passing many times through the beam splitter. So why isn't the prediction for LIGO, the naive prediction of the square root of L Planck of T Planck over 2, and for GEO600 many times greater than that, because you cycle in GEO600 many times through the beam splitter?
Yeah. So the way to think about it is that the beam splitter is doing an effective, it's a bounded random walk. So every time the light goes there and back, its position is drawn freshly again.
Right. So why isn't it for GEO600 a parameter in the prediction, which is the square root of the number of times the photons pass through the beam splitter, which would greatly enhance the prediction of the noise level for GEO600 and leave LIGO with the prediction that's ruled out by the LIGO result. That is, you subtracted, you divided by some factor between the GEO 600 and the LIGO results, but it seems like, if I understand your argument, you should have enhanced the prediction for GEO 600 by a large factor and kept the prediction for LIGO where it was, at square root of L Planck of T Planck over 2.
Well, so I kind of need a chalkboard to do this. It's not like the thing is random walking. Remember that GEO 600 is we're talking about frequencies much lower than the light travel time. And so if you measure the behavior that I said, that the thing is like a new sample every light travel time from a fixed distribution. After you do many samples like that, the mean of the samples is actually narrower than the distribution. Okay, now it does actually get somewhat more classical, if you like. I mean, if you're talking about the position wandering, okay. Now, if you put that back into gravitational wave language, you get the answer that I said. But it's not like tossing a coin and accumulating random steps wandering farther and farther away. It's like making repeated measurements with noise of a distribution, which actually means that the mean becomes better determined with time. I don't know if I said that very well. I think you have correctly stated the point that GEO 600 is enhanced relative to LIGO, but and that is the amount of noise that it sees is enhanced relative to LIGO. But the amount of noise is less than you might have thought, just because of this thing. It's a bounded random walk. It doesn't keep random walking. It keeps getting samples from a distribution of a fixed width determined by one light travel time. I don't know. Anyway, it's kind of a detailed question about how it works.
Maybe this needs to be settled, given that the connection is about the bridges. But I would need to understand where the parameter for the number of cycles through the mirror is in the actual prediction.
Yeah.
Maybe there are other people have other questions. I don't want to monopolize this.
Okay, so first of all, I think we just transitioned into the question and answering period. So let's thank the speaker for the talk and then start with the questions.
Yeah. All right. All right.
Okay, so I have a question, which is, as you pointed out in slide 53, if your effect were longitudinal, LIGO would have seen it. So a few years ago, Jack Eng in North Carolina and Giovanni Vanino Camelli in Italy had posited that there was a sort of longitudinal effect, just by looking at sort of uncertainties in displacement. And so they were very excited because the effect could be seen by LIGO. But then when they tried to talk to Ray Wise about it, what Wise said was, well, look, because these interferometers have had such a large light power, you're really talking about not a single measurement, but actually millions of photons, which are essentially going to smother your effect. That is, they're going to average out your effect and make it not visible. Why isn't something similar here?
Well, okay. So the effect of the millions of photons, right, is the point of that, is to increase the precision with which you measure the phase of the signal, okay, measuring the position of the thing to that precision. When you design the interferometer, there are these competing effects. That is, the more power you pour into the laser, the more this photon shot noise goes down, because you measure the phase more accurately. But correspondingly, putting more power into the system, there's a reaction force on the mirror, which increases. Okay? And so that's why the standard is a little bit designed to be interferometer. And the interferometers as of now, they're not quite at the standard quantum limit at low frequencies. Well, they're approaching that Schottner limit at the higher frequency. Basically, all of Ray's comments apply the same both ways. The only new thing here is that character of the noise, of the quantum gravity noise, is different, and it doesn't. In other words, it doesn't show up as. It's not the same as random walking positions of everything in all directions at the Planck scale, like the Emiliana-Camelia and Ng effect. It is only a transverse random walk. It's only a transverse random walk. Transverse to wavefront.
But if each photon has a different sort of walk, and you have millions of them, why doesn't it all average out?
The prediction for them, you're asking why the photon noise doesn't dominate. Is that what you're asking?
No, I'm saying that the effect here is you're not measuring the position of an electron or something. You're really averaging out. The position of millions of photons.
Okay. I've talked with Ray about this. It's not the position of the photons that matters. It's the position of the beam splitter that matters. So you can describe the photon field as classical plane wave, as far as this effect is concerned. And in fact, it's better to do that. And so it's not the fact that any individual photon is changing its angular trajectory or anything like that. It really is better to think about it in terms of wavefront. It's one wavefront reflecting off the beam splitter at one time, and so you don't have to identify that with a particular point in the beam splitter. It reflects off the entire beam splitter, and its transverse reflected phase then shows. The position of the entire beam splitter surface. Okay, it really is a coherent reflection of the entire surface. And then the same way with a wavefront coming from the other arm, for the second reflection, it's the whole wavefront off the entire surface. So it really is a coherent effect of all the photons. They don't cancel each other out. They're making a coherent measurement of a coherent position. And what we're saying is that the position of that whole surface is described by one transverse parameter. And that parameter has the holographic noise in it. That transverse position.
Okay. Further questions?
Just to follow up on what Jorge was saying, but I mean, if you assume that the whole thing is just a coherent reflection and one is just measuring the one position, then it's fine. But why is that justified? Supposing I did look at individual photons, why is that wrong?
Oh, well, okay, so this is about, that's a more subtle issue about how interferometers work, okay, that's about photon state. And I guess that's kind of beyond the scope of this talk, though. I mean, I'm taking that for granted, that, I mean, using the standard optical description of an interferometer, except for instead of having a classical position for the beam splitter, I'm saying it's described by this quantum state. Yeah.
Okay, you gave us such a nice motivation and everything, but supposing I just wanted to look at what is the heart of the argument.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the heart of the argument is just this precisely this relation that you had, which is sigma times sigma prime.
Yeah.
Is equal to lambda times alpha, right? I mean, and so would you agree that if there was any mechanism whatsoever which produced this this relation?
Yeah.
This is on slide 43, for example. Then in fact you'd be happy that the argument will just go from there. And the whole idea about what happened before, I mean, motivating remarks, are not directly needed. Is that correct?
Well, no, that's absolutely right. In fact, exactly. No, that's right. I mean, I think that, and that's, that's why this set of ideas works. I'm really starting from the middle of the problem instead of the beginning. And so, you know, yes, the as long as you interpret those symbols the right way, I mean, basically those sigmas refer to width of wave functions in wavefront, right? It's a transverse wave function. And between two sheets separated, you know, with a null separation. But as long as you take that interpretation, you know, as long as you map onto that interpretation the right way, you'll get the same effect. Absolutely. That's right. But I do think it's a generic effect of emergent spacetime. I mean, if you have a Planck limiting frequency and so on, you'll get it. In fact, the more general that can be made, the better, because it motivates the experiments better. I mean, basically, it increases the impact of a null result, right? If they don't see holographic matter, if it goes away, it's still interesting if you can rule out this kind of effect.
But also conversely, I mean, I think it's good to sort of focus on what's the heart of the matter. So if, in fact, one came out theoretically some argument which says that this leads to some other contradiction or something, then the argument would be flawed. I mean, so I think it's good to focus on this. The other thing is that I just confused about the fact that at the low frequency, and for GO600, as your graphs, as you emphasized, in fact, this correction doesn't really correct the curve, right?
It doesn't fix the whole thing. That's right.
So why is that not already a problem?
Well, it means that there's still unexplained noise in the system. This is right. So it's like a page on slide 52. So so I just a couple remarks about that. But the first remark is that first of all, it does explain all the mystery noise at their most sensitive frequency and above, and that's where the noise that they have is best understood. That is, the rest of the noise model, and you can see that from the other slides, it's dominated by the photon shot noise, which is really where all the physics of it is really understood. In other words, that was kind of the worst mystery noise. It was the least easy to explain away. At low frequencies, there are lots of candidates. I wouldn't say lots of candidates, the wrong way to say it. People are always unearthing unexpected difficulties at low frequencies. This is where the environment intrudes on the apparatus. It's why they have to invent all those elaborate suspension systems for LIGO and GO600 is to isolate the pendulums from, you know, earth shaking, seism, you know, gravitational noise in the environment. All of that is coming from low frequencies. So it's not so surprising that you still have an unexplained noise at low frequencies. In fact, this is one of the reasons why the follow-up experiment would be at high frequencies, because it's easier to design a clean experiment there.
So higher than what they have looked at so far, is that it?
Say again?
So frequencies which are even higher than what they have been looking at.
That's right. Yeah. So the follow-up experiment would be actually megahertz frequencies instead of kilohertz frequencies. That's right.
Okay. And I just had a sort of question, just a general question, really. I mean, you gave a lot of motivation in the beginning about, you know, with this picture of the black hole entropy and the big picture of John Wheeler's, the black hole evaporation, and so on. All those things, actually, I mean, many of these arguments that you are giving, are there also in loop quantum gravity?
Yes.
As we understand it. I mean, is there a reason why you think that what loop quantum gravity says is not appropriate?
None whatsoever. I'm just mostly ignorant of loop quantum gravity. That's the main thing. That's about it, actually.
No, but I think, actually, so far, we don't have a direct... I mean, it's not based on holography, as ADFCHT would be, for example.
Yeah.
And so maybe that is a strong reason for you. So I was just trying to understand that. But then, again, I feel that your main argument really is not related to holography. It is related to this uncertain relation, which could come from anything.
You know, I'm very interested to know whether loop quantum gravity has a holographic character in this sense, right? In the sense that I described. That would be very interesting.
But when you say holographic, it's not that the degrees of freedom in the volume are represented in the bulk. It is more that one focuses on the transverse degrees.
That's right.
That's not necessarily holographic. I mean, it's really a very small part of what people would call holographic, and not even the most most.
I think you're right. Holography is a sort of giant, sort of like string theory, giant catch-all term, much broader than what I'm discussing. I kind of adopted the holographic nomenclature, actually mainly because the optics metaphor, you know, I've been using this, you know, this Maxwell-like theory to describe the effect, which is kind of like holograms. It is sort of like a laboratory hologram, the way the waves work, the way the transverse correlations develop. That's the main reason. It wasn't really about the gravitational holography, that's how I got onto the nomenclature. But it's a good point. I actually would be very interested to know, maybe you could point me to email me some references, something about how the transverse character could emerge from loop quantum gravity. I mean, that actually sounds like another example of that is the matrix theory, right? Which is kind, you know, turns out to be holographic, although I don't think it was really invented to be that way, right?
Right.
I don't really understand the connection between those fundamental theories very well. I admit.
Okay, I mean, I can write you.
Yeah.
Let's see, so the bridge is available only until 10:30, so perhaps we can thank our speaker.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is a great pleasure.
Well, thanks very much for giving this talk.
Okay.